So the 70-year rhythm is something very important for us to keep in mind macrocosmically as well as microcosmically. And Steiner even said, and here again bearing the mark of the threefold social order, that after 70 years, a corporation should, as it were, die. It should do itself in and give up its assets to create smaller companies, to create what we would call today spin-offs. Pardon me? Rudolf Steiner said that, that like a human being, a corporation has a 70-year biography. And one that lasts longer than that is going to do potentially more harm than good. And certainly since 2008, a whole lot of corporations that were 70, 80, 90 years old suddenly collapsed, suddenly failed, or were amalgamated, or were broken up into smaller pieces. I've taken this idea a little further and brought this to my colleagues in the Waldorf movement, that when a school turns 70, it should really reassess itself and see if perhaps it needs to divide into two schools, or maybe help a charter form in its neighborhood and reform itself in a new way. Now, there aren't too many Waldorf schools that are 70 yet in the United States, so we don't have any way of testing that. But it's an interesting thing to see what happens to an institution when it turns 70 as well. And of course, Camp Hill will be looking at this issue at a certain point, not quite, well, sort of yet, yeah, right? Yeah, yeah. So, okay, 1919. For years before World War I and continuing during the war, Steiner spoke again and again, came back again and again to the theme of death, of life after death, tracing the soul's progress, tracing the soul's transformation, tracing the relationship of body, soul, and spirit as that threshold was crossed, and giving remarkable verses to those who had died. This was before the war, as though he was preparing humanity, or at least those who had ears to hear, for the cataclysm that was to come. So Steiner always has this proactive quality, sometimes perhaps 1,000 years proactive in advance. But in this case, it was right there, right in the service of people who would lose their loved ones. And he spoke especially at times about how different it is for someone who dies after age 70 or 80, who is able then to move very quickly into the etheric world, into the spiritual world, and begin the rikshaw, the replay of their life, and experience kama loka. Whereas for somebody who dies young, a child, or someone in their teenage years or their early 20s, anyone who dies before their preordained age of 70, so karmically somebody may have to die young, but nonetheless, the spiritual world always, as it were, creates a niche in human life for a person to live to 70. So if someone dies at 30, they have 40 years when they could have lived. They do not fully go into the spiritual world, but they remain closer to us. They remain in a place where, in a way, their intentions can be realized by those who are still living. What they would have done had they lived longer, what karma they would have tried to, in some way or other, work with. So he said the death of young people is something for which we must stand in great reverence. And in later years, when he developed for the Christian community the funeral service for the death of a child, a priest who saw Steiner shortly afterwards, he said this was done under tremendous time duress, and he was standing outside of the room where Steiner was, and knocked on the door and said, "Herr Doctor, we need that now." And Steiner said, "Come in." And Steiner said, "Here." And he had tears in his eyes, because, of course, he didn't write this. It was given to him. And he said, "It is so beautiful. So beautiful. And this is what World War I was about." Now, I'm going to be reading you some statistics because they're hard to carry. They're so overwhelming in many ways. In World War I, now, record-keeping and the chaos of that time, these estimates are often widely varying, but approximately 9 to 11 million military personnel died in the war. In the United States, in a modern war, if we're talking about losing 10 or 20,000 troops, that's a big national disaster. 9 to 11 million military personnel died. 20 million more were wounded. And because of the technological development of weaponry in those days, because the first tanks were ever used in war, the first airplanes and aerial bombardment, very inaccurate, but nonetheless, people were hurt. Much more powerful artillery, much more powerful rifles, shells that were made to shatter so that they'd be able to wound 5 or 6 people instead of killing only one, and poison gas used for the first time in warfare. As Steiner said, anything technological, its first use is probably going to be aggressive. And so it was. So the wounding was horrific. And it revolutionized plastic surgery. It revolutionized the use of prosthetics. People were walking around with half a face, with missing limbs and so on. There was an exhibition a few years ago at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City on Dada and surrealism. And they said that the surrealists, with, you know, eyes melting on a landscape and things like that, and a nose up in a tree and an arm down there, that they actually were simply painting what humanity looked like in Europe at that time. That this was walking surrealism of people whose bodies were put together. So 20 million people like that, most wounded seriously or gassed to a point where their respiratory system just couldn't really serve them very well. 6 to 8 million civilians died, many of them children, many of them women, because the men were all dying in the battlefield. So it's only the women and children and the aged who were left. 40 to 50 million casualties directly of the war that stretched from 2014 to the armistice, August 2014 to the armistice, November 11th, 2018. And after the armistice was signed, end of the war, no more fighting, 500,000 more casualties. Why? Because American soldiers, many of them, had just landed in Europe. America joined the war very, very late. They had their guns, they had their training, and their commander said, "Oh, what the hell, just go ahead, shoot over there." Wanted to give those boys a story to take home with them. They said that the Germans were fighting for political reasons, the French were fighting for land, the British were fighting for the seas, the Americans were fighting for souvenirs. Some things don't change. Okay, that's the war. However, as the war was coming to an end, military personnel in Europe started to show signs of a strange and rather rapid illness. In fact, they could show a high fever and die within 3 hours. They could show a high fever and have breathing problems and die within a day. This was the first occasion of what was to be known as the Spanish flu, possibly because Spain was neutral in the war, so everybody could blame them without being politically incorrect. The Spanish flu in 1 year killed more people than the Black Plague had killed in 4 years. It is to this day the most prevalent, the largest epidemic ever seen on the face of the earth. It came all over the world like the war. 500 million people were infected. World population at that time was 1.5 billion. One third of the world's population was infected. It especially hit, of course, children under 5, people over 65, that's to be expected. It skipped the older children, it skipped the teenage years, and hit hardest of all people between 20 to 40. The same age who had just survived the war, now they were being hit with the flu. And that age group had the highest mortality rate. So once again, people dying before their time, people dying prematurely, people dying young. What is going on here? What did Steiner have to say about this? 50 million deaths. So 10% of those who were infected with this disease died. And as I said, usually the death was very, very rapid. This flu, which is called the 1918 H1N1, they didn't name it that in those days, but it's been named that retroactively, it remained viable and powerful for 38 years. From 1919 to 1957. And that is approximately 2 moon nodes. A century has its moon nodes as well. The first moon node, approximately the year 1919. The second moon node, the year 1938, when World War II was in genesis. Another interesting story of numbers here. So the flu became a tremendous killer. So we're talking about a total of 50 million casualties to the war, 500 million casualties to the flu, a death toll of 20 million for the war, 50 million for the flu, 70, 75 million people, perhaps even more. Worldwide, because records weren't always kept so well, died from 1914 to 1920 or so. And Steiner was then, 1919, in the thick of this. Germany, of course, having been blockaded during the war by the British Navy, had suffered serious malnutrition for years. And even after the armistice was signed, the British said they would not lower the blockade until the peace treaty was signed, which would not happen for another 7 months. They said, we don't trust the Germans. They're going to try to start another war. As soon as we take the blockade away, they'll show up with the Navy and they'll try to invade Britain. And the propaganda machine was so powerful that people really believed this. Oddly enough, it was the United States that came to Germany's aid. And it was one man who really pushed this through who said, we are not fighting with Germany's children. And this was the man who led the first great humanitarian relief efforts of the 20th century. He was to do this again in the Soviet Union when they had drought and tremendous problems with their first collective farms. Again, he said, we have the grain in the United States, let's help them. This was Herbert Hoover, of all people. He couldn't help his own people in 1932, but anyway, amazing. He was quite a visionary, actually, a much more exceptional person than we might realize. And thank goodness he was there, or Germany would have lost probably another 10, 20 million people. Again, all of them young. But the stories that people told, the journalists who visited Germany in 1919 described, of seeing a horse dying itself of hunger, collapsing in a street, and a dozen women rushing at it with knives. They waited for horses to die so that they could bring some meat home to their children. By the end of 1919, the average German child was 1 to 2 inches shorter than the average German child in the year 1914. These were the children who were to come to the first Waldorf school. We think we have problems today of children with screens and all of the tremendous superficiality and commercialism of our time. These were children who could barely stay awake and who had to be fed at the school. We certainly have to do that as well, but problems of malnutrition were far more severe. And this was in part, welcome, this was in part because of the tremendous animosity, jealousy, and fear that Great Britain, above all, had for Germany. Because just before the war, Germany finally became an industrial power greater than England. And Kaiser Wilhelm was building, in the midst of building, a navy that was going to be larger and probably more up-to-date than Britain's. And the British could not have this. Any pretext for war was fine with them. And already one could read tremendous propaganda coming out in the first decade of the 20th century. And the Round Table, which was probably something of a center of British Anglo-American brotherhood activity, warning about the German threat and German aggression. Here's England with all of its colonies accusing Germany of being the most aggressive nation on earth. But nonetheless, as Steiner pointed out, there were all kinds of errors leading to that war and all kinds of errors at its conclusion as well. So this takes us now to Paris, where in January of 1919, the Paris Peace Conference begins. This has been beautifully embodied in a play by Albert Steffen, one of the individuals closest to Rudolf Steiner at this time, who was later to take on the mantle of the leadership of the society after Steiner's death. He wrote a play called Peace Tragedy. You wouldn't think those two words belong together, but that is indeed what this was. 32 countries gathered in Paris, not all of them combatants in the war, but all of them sharing, or most of them anyway, sharing the same concerns and the same interest in what the American president, who is present there, Woodrow Wilson, had proposed as the 14 points. And for them, the most important of these 14 points was not the League of Nations, but rather self-determination. It was Wilson's idea that every group of people sharing a common language, sharing common traditions, common religion, should find the way to create their own national state. And this sounded wonderful because, of course, what had been fought against and what was definitely falling apart were the empires of the 19th century. Britain still held on with a really claustrophobic grip to its colonies, but Germany was now going to give its colonies up, and the Ottoman Empire, one of the great military and social forces of its time, which controlled the entire Mideast, now also had been overcome, especially through the brilliant military tactics of T.E. Lawrence, a British adventurer known to this day as Lawrence of Arabia, even the hero of an American movie, American-British movie made some years ago. T.E. Lawrence, who organized some of the most successful guerrilla war ever and managed to blow up railroad lines that were conveying munitions and supplies from Germany to the Ottoman Empire, conveying food and supplies from the Ottoman Empire to Germany. And with that, he really broke down the supply lines and helped the Allies, who were England, France, Italy, later joined by the United States, Russia, which had its own separate peace in 1917 and dropped out. So now these Allies were together, how to break up the empire. There was certainly idealism connected to this, but here again, the British and the French in particular realized that it was in their interest to atomize, to fragment the empires, because that way they'd be fighting with each other. And they sent agents, provocateurs, intrigue to all of these little groups saying, you know, they don't practice the Islamic religion. How can you say they're your friends, they're your neighbors? They're not. They're your enemies. They're Christians. You know, fight with them. Get rid of them. Drive them out. Turkey, Armenians, Islam, Christians, and so on, all over, people speaking different languages, different dialects, are suddenly quarreling and streaming to this peace conference to try to get their due. In particular, even as far away as China, there was a Chinese delegation that came and demanded its sovereignty over lands that the Germans had taken from them by sort of colonizing part of China years before. The British and the French wanted the natural resources of these countries. They wanted their mines. They wanted their water supplies. They wanted, in particular, and the British were the smartest here of all the countries, even outsmarting the United States, the British saw what it would take to win a war in the future. Not just good technology, not just sturdy British yeoman soldiers, gasoline, petroleum, oil. And where were the greatest supplies of oil to be found in the world at that time? Pennsylvania, United States. Also, by then, Oklahoma and Texas were recognized as possible sites, but that didn't help Europe very much. For them, it was southern Russia, where Stalin was already working for the Rothschilds in the oil fields before the war, creating all kinds of difficulties there, organizing the workers so that Russia would get that oil and not Western Europe, and also, of course, the Mideast, where it was just recognized at that time that Arabian countries had a great deal of oil.